28, nearly 29 minutes past 9 this Thursday morning. A few weeks ago, a story caught our eye about what was a quote-unquote mysterious epidemic. And immediately I'm going, what the hell does that mean? And this was emerging in the wake of the pandemic, and it highlighted a sudden upsurge of physical and vocal tics, of all things, and indeed convulsions that were happening amongst teenagers and young women. And the thought was that it may have been caused by the pressure of lockdown on young people who've been living, obviously, a very surreal experience, like I was talking about earlier on. And we wanted to know really a lot more about how these behaviours manifest themselves, which is why we're joined now by Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan, who is a consultant neurologist at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery in London. Good morning, Suzanne. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
When you heard about that story about the mysterious epidemic and the sudden upsurge of physical and vocal tics, as I was describing there, did your ears pick up and think, what the hell's happening here?
Well, my ears did prick up, but not because I was sort of thinking, what the hell's happening here? I was, because it's so familiar. Mm. Working as a neurologist, you see these sort of phenomena all the time. Where people are having sort of physical symptoms that spread through sort of social communities and are not explained by disease. So it's actually very common. And also, you know, the use of the word mystery illness when referring to it is also common. It really isn't all that mysterious. It's very easy for symptoms to spread just through searching your body to see if there might be something wrong. You begin noticing things, and that can produce these sort of phenomenon.
And you've written about this before. You wrote Sleeping Beauties and other stories of mystery illness. So you're exactly who we need to speak to about this morning. So when you see, for example, the so-called epidemic of vocal tics and convulsions, how does something that doesn't sound to me that physical become contagious?
Well, it's actually really very simple process. So at an unconscious level, we have cognitive mechanisms that are making us efficient in the world. So I think most people sort of think that they're really over in control of their movements, in control of their sort of what they're perceiving in their environment and in their body, for example. But in fact, the vast majority of movement and sensory control is happening at an unconscious level. Otherwise, every time we cross the road, we'd have to think for a long time, like a five-year-old, is that car, am I safe? How fast is that car moving? So we have all these unconscious processes allowing us to walk without thinking, pick things up without thinking, judge the world without thinking. Mm-hmm. But if we become exposed to an illness and we believe that illness might be contagious, what that does is it brings those unconscious processes into our conscious minds. So we start thinking, oh, well, do I feel sick? And you begin examining mm-hmm. your body for different sorts of symptoms. And I like to think of it as like a sports person. So someone can take a penalty kick without any difficulty in front of, you know, a small number of people. But when they're under scrutiny and in front of a big crowd and they have to think about their movements in much more detail, it completely can throw those movements completely awry. So just the way you think about your body and perceive your body changes the quality of movements and sensations and can produce physical symptoms.
And can the description that you've outlined in terms of, say, the atmosphere in a room or expectations from peers, can that alter your mind sufficiently for it to play tricks on you and make you feel unwell where you mightn't have if those circumstances didn't exist?
100%. I mean, if you just think of it, we must have all had this experience in the pandemic where we were being told repeatedly to look out for sore throats or feelings of being unwell in any particular day. I bought a thermometer at the beginning of the pandemic. I repeatedly thought I had a high temperature, kept taking my temperature. I never had a high temperature, you know, and everyone has this experience. Mm. And it's the same if you know, nervous anxiety makes people want to go to the toilet, or if you say to people, you know, whatever you do during this half hour segment, don't cough. You know, what happens is you immediately start thinking of the symptom and noticing changes in your body. So there's nothing as you can produce symptoms just by trying to sort of suppress them or by thinking about them or noticing your body more than normal.
Why would you say, Suzanne, in a group of, say, 10 people, one, maybe two, but mostly one, is constantly worried about being sick, is constantly on the cusp of being unwell, talks about nothing else but ailments and has drawers of hocus-pocus medicines, some real or imagined, in terms of effectiveness. What's that person's road? Can you explain why that person it feels that way?
I can't say that I can explain it for an individual,
sure.
But we have genetic tendencies and we also have things in the environment that mold our personalities. So some people, because of genetic reasons, will be more inclined to kind of neuroticism, worrying about things, anxiety. But also in your upbringing, if you've been exposed to a lot of illness, or depending on the way your family responded if you got sick, you know, if sickness resulted in a lot of medicalization or staying off school, for example, then that's going to alter how you are later in life and your attitude to small symptoms within your body. So it's probably partially genetic, partially upbringing and environment.
I always feel if somebody describes somebody else as psychosomatic and having a tendency to be psychosomatic when it comes to illnesses, that they tend to be, it's almost like a pejorative term nearly to describe somebody. Would you agree with that or is it?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that it tends to be portrayed in a pejorative way.
Yes.
And that really is the really big problem. So all of our bodies are constantly speaking of our thoughts and how we feel. So I think people kind of think that their thoughts are just held within their heads. But actually, you can look at someone and say, you know, that person looks like they're having a bad day.
Mm.
That person looks confident. That person looks shy. Or if you even summon up, you know, a memory, whether it be a sad one or a happy one, you feel physical changes with that. So our thoughts are not something that exist within our heads. They're embodied. So we have constant physical changes related to feelings, ideas, thoughts and beliefs. And that's completely normal. So if I'm nervous, my heart rate goes up, or if I'm nervous, my hands shake. That's a psychosomatic symptom, but it's not an illness. It's unfortunately how we respond to those symptoms that can produce illness. And that shouldn't be viewed as sort of a pejorative thing, because really it's just a feature of the human condition. And when it leads to disability, it's just an illness like any other.
What is dissociation? Can you define it for us?
So dissociation can be a normal thing for people. So mm-hmm. for example, you know, it's that feeling where your awareness and your attention drift apart. So for example, you are listening to a news broadcast, you're desperate to hear a particular result or a particular piece of the news, and your mind just keeps wandering away and you miss it and you have to keep replaying the same segment. Or you read the page of a book and you get to the bottom of a page of a book, you've taken in none of the information.
Mm.
That's because the awareness attention have drifted apart, they've dissociated, so you're not taking in information adequately. And that's normal. It happens to all of us. You know, there cannot be anyone who hasn't had those sorts of experiences. And it's there probably as a protective mechanism. So, you know, if you're terribly overloaded or if you've got really negative thoughts and you don't want to be constantly sort of reminded of something negative, then dissociation is a sort of a way that the mind protects itself from being overloaded or from things that it doesn't wish to think about all the time. And like anything, you know, the body goes wrong. Every aspect of the body goes wrong in some way. And for some people, dissociation can lead to medical illness, sometimes psychiatric illness, where people have problems like derealization and depersonalization, so they don't feel things or themselves are real. And in the case of my personal medical practice, it can lead to blackouts and seizures. So I see a lot of people who have prolonged episodes of loss of consciousness and actual convulsions as a result of dissociation. That's when dissociation goes very, very wrong.
In passing yesterday, I was talking about witches and how it seemed to be an excuse for certain bunches of men down through the history of time to look at a certain type of woman and say, you're very inconvenient to society, therefore you're a witch, therefore you will be burnt. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know what, where I'm going with this. That brings us into, of course, the Crucible story and the mass hysteria. And again, mm-hmm. let's start actually this the train of thought with that word hysteria, because it has a very feminine twist to it. Talk to me about that, please.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, hysteria was the name that we once gave to psychosomatic symptoms. And obviously, since hysteria is drawn from the Greek word for womb, it clearly is implying that this is a female condition.
Right.
In fact, men are also affected by psychosomatic conditions. However, I would say that it is true to say that women are more often affected. But I think what's very interesting to observe is how women are treated when they're affected by this condition. So just on the subject of tics, in 2011, a group of schoolgirls in their teens in a school in upstate New York called Leroy developed these contagious tics. So they don't just spread through things like social media. Within a group of friends, 12 people developed tics and convulsions that spread. And it was very interesting to see how the young women were talked about. One newspaper headline called them the Witches of Leroy.
Wow.
And they were also sort of compared, they were, it was implied that they were weak and that they were fragile. When you get psychosomatic symptoms in men, that sort of pejorative conversation tends not to happen. In fact, very often when men are affected, it's seen as implying that this couldn't be hysteria and this couldn't be psychosomatic diagnosis. So this diagnosis is denied for men and used as a judgment against women.
That's remarkable. I mean, that all comes back from the 17th century onwards.
Yeah, I mean, these sort of outbreaks have been happening, you know, throughout history. You will find multiple examples of laughing epidemics, dancing epidemics, seizure epidemics. These things are terribly, terribly common. The symptoms are often very, very similar between different groups, but how they spread and how people explain them are really comes from the cultural environment in which they occur. So in the distant past, we might have used witches to explain this, and in the present, we used COVID and 5G to explain it.
Yeah, amazing. The mosquito people you studied, and I'd love you to tell us a bit about them.
Yeah, so this is another example of a sort of social contagion. So mosquito people come from the mosquito tribe, which live in Nicaragua on the Mosquito Coast. Mm-hmm. They are indigenous people of Nicaragua, and they have a condition called greasy sickness, which spreads from teen to teen, often affecting young women. And it manifests as sort of frenetic behavior where they run frantically and then they collapse on the ground and they have seizures and what the local people refer to as super strength. So the local people say that take four grown men to sort of pin down a young woman if she's having one of these seizures. And what's interesting about this condition is that they have their own sort of colloquial explanations for it. They explain it based on a demonic possession, which makes it sound sort of like it's a superstition that we might wish to kind of look down on in some way. But actually, when you examine it academically, it's an incredibly sophisticated process that the mosquito people use to solve particular social problems. So if a young woman is distressed, particularly if she's being sexualized by older men, if she finds herself in a trap position, she starts having these seizures. And what the seizures indicate to the community is, I'm distressed, something bad is happening, I need you to support me. The community come to support her without that need for the awkward conversation that people have difficulty having. It's a way of saying, I need help, without having to be too explicit about the reason that you need help. And because it attracts a community response, it's incredibly treatable. It gets better. Whereas unfortunately, in Western communities, so we may look at the mosquito people and say, oh, that's superstitious and we don't respect that. But actually, people in the UK have similar sorts of seizures and they are ostracized from the community and they are medicalized with brain scans and tests and they don't get better. So I actually have a lot of admiration for the mosquito people and how they manage these problems.
Yeah, remarkable. And other studies, such as in Sweden, you talked about the refugee children falling into this sleep state for months or years at a time. You talk about the embassy in Cuba with employees hearing things at night and having, you know, headaches and memory loss. But it's among many people that hence it becomes a bigger issue. It's not just one isolated incident, or indeed the mining town in Kazakhstan, where people suffered that sleeping sickness for weeks and months at a time. I mean, as a neurologist, in the cold light of your judgment day as a medic, what do you see here? Do you see mystery, or do you see a crime with solution?
Yeah, no, I don't see mystery. Yeah. And I think it's because I'm sort of, I feel myself personally very aware of the sort of bodily changes that I experience with my emotional state or with ideas or anxieties. And I don't feel that these things are terribly mysterious. But when I track these different contagions around the world, I find them by Googling the words mystery illness, because that seems to be how other people feel the need to portray them.
Yeah.
And I think it's because people are really struggle to understand the link between our cognitive processes that make up the mind and the brain and the body. And I think we're still so uncomfortable with talking about psychological illness, and we're so uncomfortable talking about psychosomatic illness that we prefer to just see them as mysteries. But honestly, I mean, who hasn't, you know, our hands shake, our hearts go too fast, our stomach, you know, gets upset. We all have these constant physical changes because of things that are happening in our lives. So I don't understand, I suppose, why it's so difficult for people to say, well, perhaps bigger problems can cause bigger physical changes.
Let me ask you about Patrick in Dublin text. He says hysteria could be argued was experienced nationally in Ireland with the moving statues in the 1980s. Would that be a fair shout, or is that an unwise use attribution of the term?
Well, I think these things are related, but it's always very difficult because when you begin to associate, I think that these things are social contagions, and some people, and I don't think this is a fault in the person, it's just a feature of some people, are suggestible. And you can be suggestible in different ways. And, you know, that means that some people can be socially sort of affected to produce eating disorders or to see moving statues or to have tick-like movements. The problem is when we associate all of these things together. You know, if you say to someone who's having seizures, for example, you liken them to someone who is seeing moving statues, you know, it creates a sort of feeling that their problem is being diminished in some way. So while I do feel that there's a common psychological mechanisms to these, I don't necessarily feel the comparison is practically helpful to patients.
Could you ask your guest, Adrian in Dublin, asks, is it a form of mass hysteria like the dancing plague across Europe in the Middle Ages? Now, you did refer to the dancing plague, though, Suzanne. I've never heard of it.
Yeah, so it was a dancing plague. I'm going to get my dates slightly wrong. Something around 1512 in Strasbourg. Don't hold me to that, but roughly. There was a dancing plague, and, you know, thousands of people were affected. And I think some people actually died, but that was because they had underlying health conditions and had heart problems that caused them to die. What happens is that, you know, these sort of contagious symptoms, they begin with something relevant to that place and time that sets the form that the plague will take.
Okay.
So, for example, if we talk about Havana syndrome, which was the example you mentioned in the U.S. Embassy in the States, or U.S. Embassy in Cuba, a group of diplomats believed that they had been exposed to a sonic weapon. Now, that made sense to those people in that time, because sound weapons existed in the history of espionage, and it chimed with what we understand about biology and physics now. I don't know exactly how the dancing plague came about, but that will have been triggered by something that was relevant to that time and place. So these are all related phenomena, but the form they take has cultural relevance to the place and time of the outbreak.
It's absolutely fascinating, the study of it, because, as you say, it can, depending on the time and place, it can be relevant to the manifestation of what was happening, and yet still it goes. Do you see the internet as being a problem, or as a useful excuse?
Yeah, more useful excuse, I would say. I think that, you know, these things have always happened, and, you know, if you look at sort of, there was a outbreak of fatigue-like illness throughout the world in the mid 19th century, and at that time they said, oh well, it's blamed on the fast pace of life, for example, and we're still saying the same thing now. So I think these things will always happen. The internet may cause them to spread slightly differently, so they spread from the States to the UK, you know, seamlessly.
Well, maybe we'll have another dancing play, given that it's perfectly built for TikTok. I mean, when you think of
well, you start the trend and we'll see what happens.
I did last Friday. No, okay. Let me ask you a question, if I may, from a listener, which says, how do you treat this? That is to say, mass hysteria or the convulsions, style sicknesses. How do you treat or quote unquote fix this?
Yeah. So it really depends on the situation. If we take the example that you started with of these TikTok tics, so these are children or teenagers really on TikTok developing tics that are a little like Tourette's syndrome but are not Tourette's syndrome. I mean, the most important thing is not to pathologize or medicalize mm-hmm. where necessary. If you're caught in a social contagion, what you want to do is find a new peer group or turn away from whatever is triggering this. So these are all about the attention you pay to your body, the anxiety around the symptoms. So if you turn off either TikTok completely or you just look at different media content and you don't, you know, become excessively anxious, often that is quite enough to make people better. Occasionally, these phenomena will come along with serious mental health problems. So someone will be otherwise ill, and this will just be one feature of it. And those people will need to get psychological support.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you this morning from London. Suzanne, thank you very much for your time, and no doubt we'll talk again.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. That's Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan joining us live from London town. She's the author of Sleeping Beauties and Other Stories of Mystery Illness. An intriguing conversation. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. It's 11 minutes to 10. We've much to do. Back shortly.